My mother worked, she worked in a, which was the largest Catholic church in Lodz, where the front of the church was the border and the back was the ghetto. They brought in there the bedding, which was in Poland, a bedding of feathers. We didn't have here you've got artificial beddings and so, all feathers, goose feathers, to make sure that the good ones. They brought beddings in. By that time, people were, hundreds of thousands of people were taking the homes. And they brought the transports, massive transport with beddings, where in that church, they sorted out the feathers, certain great feathers, which was put in bales in black to Germany for bedding for the Germans, and some coarse feathers, other feathers, in other bales, which was used for raw material, because they needed everything they could possibly get. That was her job. My two sisters worked in the laundry. They set up a massive, massive laundry with the latest equipment, which served only to clean uniforms. I know they told this many times, that's brought in uniforms which were completely stiff from blood when they were injured. But they didn't waste it, brought it back to the ghetto, cleaned it, and made it like new and back to Germany. If somebody says to me, what I say is the most, what can I describe the most horrible, tragic moment in the 4.5 years together? See, I was, there are not many people who survived the ghetto in Lodz, who were from day one, from May 1st to August, when it was completely liquidated in 1944. Because they died, they brought them from the provinces, and so somehow I managed, I carried on. Why? It happened. Because a total of 204,000 Jews passed through the ghetto in the 4.5 years. Uh, 70,000 was still left when they liquidated in August 1944, which I'll come to it, and it is estimated between 4,000 and 5,000 out of the 204,000 have survived.
But you're saying your worst moment?
The worst moment was in September 1942, which was exactly a week before our Jewish New Year. It didn't mean anything by that time, the Jewish New Year. We just had to go to work and that's it. And you say, how did we know? There were no calendars, no papers. How did we know? They haven't done anything. But our parents were clever. They went by the moon. Now our calendar is the lunar calendar. By the moon, they knew, right, this is the full moon, tonight is the Jewish New Year. So a week before that, September 1942, posters, this was all the time for various reasons, posters in German and in Polish, over the ghetto, that tomorrow at 12 o'clock, Rumkowski will deliver, Rumkowski's got news for us, he will deliver a speech to us. And so again, I was the only one of my family who went there, but there must have been at least 30,000-40,000 in that place where they hung these 23 people, that big place where all the coaches came in from before the war. Comes in the rostrum there, his thick glasses, I remember, a grey suit with a grey hat. He looked like a lord. And for some reason, he became more powerful and younger by the day. It's a mystery. How, what made him do this? Is he? But he became so involved in his work in this ghetto. And he, I would say that man had in his mind that if he keeps us working, he was such a communal man before the war, and if we can get only a few hundred, a few thousand Jews to survive, he will be able to rebuild the community. The Jews will the flood again. I'm sure that went through his mind. He gets in the roster and he says, I've got good news for you and I've got bad news for you. First, the bad news. I've got an order to deliver 20,000 people to be made up of old children up to the age of 10, all old people and all sick people. The good news is they wanted 23,000 and he bargained them down to 20. Made a good deal. I know how you feel, said, but to come and tell you a week before the Shoshana, before the New Year, that you should give your children for a korban, which means a sacrifice, is not easy, but you must do it. Because if you won't do it, you won't be able to work, and you know what will happen. And if you want to carry on working, hoping to survive, this is what you got to do. He says, I know it isn't easy for me to say it. After the war, I will say chatosi, which means in Hebrew, I will ask for pardon. Well, to come and say these words like this, for that I can never forgive the man. Never forgive him. To say what the Germans want him to do, all right. You carry out orders, and nothing else you can do. But to make excuses for that, I could never forgive him. Probably if he would have survived, I would be a witness and ask, he should stand as a war criminal. Not for the what he did, in the manner he did it. It wasn't necessary. But did he become dehumanized as well? Maybe.
So how did the crowd react?
The crowd, I've never seen, to the day I die, I'll never forget, especially mothers, young women, tearing their hair out from the head, screaming. And it all went on. The following morning, the Jewish police comes and give me the child. This went on for 2 days. People rebelled, the several policemen were killed, knifed, bleeding all over the places. He went to Gromkowski, went to the Gestapo, went to Bibov, and Bibov with the Gestapo there, and he said, I cannot do it. No, it's impossible. The people won't give up the children. I said, what can my men do? I've so many already injured, so many policemen killed already. This is the time where we really revolted. We said, that's it. Enough is enough. And then the following day, posters again all over, a curfew, complete 24-hour curfew until further notice. All right, curfew is a curfew. And then the Germans came with trucks, street after street. No, they did it very, very methodically, no problem with them. And brought all the people from Odi, from the house, and they said on loudspeakers that everybody should come out from the home into the street. And the streets, the homes will be searched. Anybody who will be found will be shot on the spot, which many did try to hide, and nobody survived. They were shot. Made a selection.
Where were you?
In Franciszkańska Street, in the ghetto. At that time, 42, September 42, the whole family were there. Yeah, the whole family, the five of us were still there. And they selected, and it was so tragic. The mothers wanted to save the children. Like they put in boys of 9, 10 in the father's trousers, just turned them up, father's trousers. I remember my mother had like paprika, a bit of paprika, kept rubbing in the cheeks to look healthy, to have rosy cheeks. So we should be selected. We didn't know what was going to happen, what happened, but we took it for granted. Whoever will be taken away as a child, as a sick person, an old, is going to die. Is going to be killed. That we had no illusion about it. Where they're going to be sent, or how they're going to be killed, no idea. But we knew it's the end. And our house, for some reason, it was the last house. It was near the fence. They started at one side and they finished up on our side, where we live. So they did, ours was 17, the odd numbers. The even numbers, and then it got became dark already, they did the selection. We could sit from our window, we could just watch them, how they selected from the house, from the opposite, from the street opposite house, the even numbers. And I said, I think back now, and I think, how did I come to be such a hero at times and do the things what I did? But again, because maybe age-wise or already different, I don't know what made me do it. I just did it. And I said, look, tomorrow morning they're going to come here to do our house, and this is the last house. So when we saw, because on the corner, this is the Franciscanska, and there is the Smogovan here on the corner, where the wires were here, there was a watchtower with the assessment standing there. I said, let's make sure that when the assessment turns towards the other part of the city, with the ghetto, with his back to the ghetto part, let's run across the other side. We won't have to face the selection. And will you believe it or not, my younger sister and myself got through. And we both stand on the other side, and there's my parents, my older sister, on the steps, and just couldn't make it or didn't want to make it. I don't know. And I following morning they came with a selection, and I watched from an attic from my house there what had happened, what's happening, looked out from a little window. And I could see I left my father, they left my sister there, but they put my mother on the truck to take her away. She was only in the 40s. I didn't ask for any identity cards, and we didn't have identity cards. Yes, oh, you look healthy, you can stay away. Oh, you already have gone. Off you go. And then, within half an hour, the curfew was lifted. What do I do? The first thing I did, I go to the Chernyetskego, to this prison assembly place. And there I see my mother near the barbed wires, near the fence. And the Jewish police is controlling it right around. I squeezed her out through the wire. I got her out. I don't know, and I don't remember to this day how I did it, what made me do, how I managed it. I don't know. And I got her out and back. And we were back again. The five were back again. But from that moment, where even a baby got a bit of a ration card, right? Because we got a ration card plus a soup during the week. You say, what was the soup? Simple. Half a liter of hot water, and if you're lucky enough, you had four pieces of these kolorum, what is it called? This vegetable, turnip, little squares. Kohlrabi, yes. Yes, that was it. If you're lucky enough, you had four. If not, when we got the soup, we said, How many pieces of kohlrabi you got? Oh, I've only got one. Oh, I've got five. You look. It all depends. If you have protection, no protections, right? With the fellow, with the whoever dished out the soup. So when if you see you, if you like it better than the next one, you put the ladle right down to the bottom, and you put a bit more out. As simple as that.
Actually, it might be called beetroot.
No. Beetroot is a different kohlrabi. Yeah, well, definitely. Yeah. So, but still, it was so called a soup. It was. But from that curfew, it became a labor camp, no more than a ghetto. Still ruled by the Jewish administration. Anybody who didn't work, no ration. Everybody had to work. Young and old. There's one here, Sam Gontarsh, who was in the youth group in Zattler, in the leather factory. Me. And we both finished up in Manchester.
I've interviewed him.
Did you? Yeah. Did he mention this? That he was in the youth group in the leather factory?
This was years ago, so.
Yeah. He must have done it. He must have, yeah. He was much younger. Normally too young to work, but he had to work. Conditions became very, very bad. No hospitals anymore. We didn't have many medication. But after that, no medication of any kind. Again, our parents, they improvised. They said, they made appointments. They made up all sorts of things from rotten potato. They made things. They became scientists. Because, you know, a child of five was already grown up. But a child of 10 was an adult. Yeah. You know all the tricks in the game. Yeah. How to steal next to a potato or a piece of or some potato peeling. Yeah. So this, we carried on, but conditions became just worse by the day there. Then June the 4th, 1944, my sister, the older sister, went down with typhoid. Now, living in one room, I remember feeling with cold water, with a teaspoon, just sips of water. And she's the only one who went down with typhoid, and the rest of us didn't get the disease. And you tell this to any medical man here, it's impossible. You tell me a story. That's fact. In fact, and by that time, conditions were so bad, already in the summer, spring, winter, the winter from 42, 43, 43, 44 was horrible. This is in the magazine, but I give you a copy of what I said. The youngsters got it a little bit wrong. That's when I said, I can only remember once, in right through the war, being as a family together for 4.5 years, or just under 5 years, you can say, where we cried. Otherwise, we're too weak to cry. Nothing to smile and too weak to cry. So it's not to smile, but no to cry, simply. Now I mentioned these, I described the curfew when the children were taken away. So. And my two sisters worked in
laundry.
Possibly 3 months after this, they took the children away. My sisters came home crying like anything. First time. It took them a long time before they could bring themselves to describe why they cried and what happened at work. Because it was only women worked there in the factory, in this big laundry. They sent back the clothing from the children, what they took away in the care, during the curfew, to the laundry, and the mothers recognized the children's clothing, cleaned it, packed it, made it like new, and back to Germany for the German children. Yeah. Now, it's... I think for that act alone, to do something like this, there shouldn't be a single German alive in this world. So, coming back to where my sister died, by that time, the people already, there were hardly a room, hardly a building where there were no dead bodies. So they just went from place to place, any bodies to collect. So, and I remember a long, narrow cart driven by a horse went around. Somehow I felt, no, I want to bury my sister. So maybe if I survive, I will come back and find a spot. And I did. I went with this cart, and I went with the cart, with the body, and I buried it myself. It was on a skeleton, and the grave was so deep and narrow, not much. It was against the brick cemetery wall. And for this, I feel that I've really done, I feel like it's an achievement. I buried it myself, and I know where she is. At the same time, I remember it was a full feeling. Somehow I was happy when I buried her. You think buried her, normally some cries, some screams. So I was happy for her. I was fine, at least I know where she is. What will happen to the rest of us, I don't know. And you can describe it as a happy funeral.
Because she had escaped the suffering, you mean?
Yeah. Finish. They escaped the suffering. And I know where she died and where she's buried. And she's got to finish, no longer to suffer. It's so behind her. And then, towards the end of July 1944, I don't know whether you're familiar, I'm sure you must be.
The July plot.
The July plot was when the Polish army asked Stalin to give them permission to liberate Warsaw. Okay? That was end of July, August.
The Warsaw Uprising.
The Uprising, yeah. But the Uprising was the Ghetto Uprising, 1943. But this was, because there was a big Polish army attached to the Russian army, as well as a Polish army attached to the British army. The Polish army, and they were all good qualified soldiers, mostly officers, with the Russian army. They were all intelligent people. A lot of these people in Poland, they were intelligent. Where in Russia before the war, there were not many great intellectuals. Very few could sign the name. In the army, there were novices. So there were 10,000 officers, and they said to Stalin, at the end of July, August, where he was going to carry on, because they were already outside the Praha, which was outside suburb of Warsaw. And they said, will you stop there? They said, Stalin, stop there, and he should let them to liberate Warsaw. He said, fine. He was quite happy. Go, it will give this army a rest. And he knew very well that every one of them will be shot, will be killed. And he wanted them dead, because there would be a nuisance for him after the war. That's exactly what he wanted. Go, get killed, fine, wonderful. And we heard by the beginning of August, at night was quiet, artillery. Well, happy. We came to work. in the morning. It's amazing, we had no radio to get, no news, nothing at all. But we had a few radios hidden. The 6th of my sister died the 4th of June. The 6th of June, when they opened the second front, we came in 7 o'clock in the morning by 5 past 7. Every one of us knew the second front is opened. Yeah, no more than 5 minutes. You can imagine the joy. And here, this bombarding we could hear. Then we heard already an uprising. The Polish army is fighting to liberate Warsaw. Great. I would say it was about maybe the 4th, the 5th of August. Posters again over the ghetto, German and Polish. And tomorrow, we want people to come again to this big open place where Hans Biboff will address us. All right? I go and I stand next to this Hans Biboff, fine, clean-looking man, dressed in civilian clothes, immaculate. And he started off, meine Juden, meine Freund. My Jews, my friends. Yeah, I can hear him now. I'm sure that you, at night when it's quiet, you can hear the artillery, which is only 130 kilometers from here. It's near Warsaw. He didn't mention the uprising, no. He said, that's where the Russian frontier is now. You worked for us, you helped us to carry out the war, we need you, we want to save you from the Russians because you know what they would do to you if we leave you here. You know what they are. The most barbaric people, those that he called them for everything. We will transport you to a safer place where you will live and work together with your families. Your machinery will go with you and there you will be kept until the war is over, when you'll be free. If you said to me, did we believe him? Yes. Of course we believe him. There was nothing else but to believe, right? So, again, they started with crooks coming to the houses, and everyone, no selection, everybody. Out from the houses into the crooks. Then we went, and he also said, just take a small rucksack with you, because clothes and food, everything will be waiting for you where you go, where we will take you. Fine. We came, so they took us, when they took us on the truck, they gave everybody a loaf of bread, which was marvelous, could eat at least. And then they took us to a place called Radogosch, which was the main railway link between the outside ghetto and the inside ghetto. And then, when we got to Radogosch, loudspeakers, all very nice, very polite, said again, meine Freund, as you can see, the railway line waiting here are cattle trucks.